as more hospitals in the northern parts of the territory stop services. Palestinian resistance fighters inflict more losses on invading Israeli forces in Gaza as fighting on the ground rages on. And Iran successfully launches yet another domestically built research satellite into space.
Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News.
Israel's onslaught on the Gaza Strip is now in its 146th day as the regime's indiscriminate strikes kill more civilians in central and southern parts of the territory. Israeli airstrikes killed at least six Palestinians in a town near Khan Yunis. Casualties were also reported following the Israeli bombardment of a residential block in Nusayrat refugee camp in central Gaza. Meanwhile, Gaza's health sector remains a main target for Israeli strikes. The Al-Auda Hospital in northern Gaza has stopped its services due to severe shortage of fuel and medical supplies. Kamal Adwan Hospital, which was the last hospital in service in northern Gaza, has also stopped working after a shutdown of its electric generator. The Israeli genocide has so far killed nearly 30,000 Gazans, leaving over 70,300 others injured. Journalist and political commentator Samuel Geddes joins us now from Melbourne. Sir, welcome to the program. First of all, give us your thoughts on how this Israeli genocidal massacre continues to unfold in Gaza. It's been 146 days as the international community sits and watches as Palestinians are being killed one by one.
Yes, well, it has certainly, along with the actual physical infrastructure of the Gaza Strip, this conflict has absolutely demolished any pretense of there existing a genuine rules-based international order, as we have seen none other than its main custodian, the United States, vetoing and stymieing every possible attempt at a ceasefire, even a temporary ceasefire. So from the developments of the last 5 months nearly, we can conclude that this has been occurring with the full approval, if not outright participation, of the United States, and that it is clearly one rule for countries such as Ukraine when they are invaded, and when it is a non-European country, it is an entirely different set of rules, or indeed no rules at all. There is no international law, no meaningful bedrock of international law on which the countries of the global south can reasonably rely. So I think we can draw much the same conclusions as we hopefully come towards the end of this particular conflict as we would have been able to draw in the first days of it.
Please also share with us your perspective on the supposed ceasefire talks that are taking place and the role that the United States has been playing in those ceasefire talks. On one hand, they have a part in these talks, and on the other hand, at the international level, in the United Nations Security Council, they shoot down every attempt to call for a humanitarian ceasefire. What are your expectations about a ceasefire, and how do you explain this U.S. hypocritical approach to it as well?
Now that the U.S. administration is actively your viewers may draw a different conclusion, but I think the fact that the U.S. administration is speaking in somewhat definite terms about a ceasefire going to happen, I think we can infer that it is ultimately due to the influence of the United States that this ceasefire is now likely to happen. Clearly, there is only so much international blowback that the American administration is willing to withstand as this massacre unfolds in front of the entire world in real time, as you mentioned. So really, I think it serves to drive home the point that the United States is the real actor behind these events, and its attempt to paint itself as earnestly trying to influence Israeli actions is nothing more than a performance. This was always done at the behest of the American government. It has gone on for as long as the US government wants it to go on, and it will ultimately end when the American administration decides that the costs have become onerous and the risks of wider regional conflict have become too great. It ultimately is not a question of Israeli decision-making. It's a question of President Biden choosing to make the guns fall silent. It ultimately is his decision.
All right, thanks a lot. Journalist and political commentator Samuel Geddes joining us from Melbourne.
Thank you.
The U.S. managed Israeli genocidal war continues to take innocent lives and leave a trail of destruction in the Gaza Strip. Israel's bombing and shelling campaign since October the 7th has turned a large part of Gaza into rubble. The spokesman for the Gaza Health Ministry gives details about the catastrophic situation in the besieged territory.
The estimated casualties of the Israeli aggression stand at approximately 30,000 martyrs and over 70,500 injuries. This points to a systematic policy by the Israeli occupation of committing genocide in the Gaza Strip. Furthermore, this aligns with reports indicating the disappearance of 10,000 individuals. 70% of these martyrs are children and women, in addition to nearly 10% of the martyrs being elderly. Therefore, the Israeli occupation is carrying out a clear process of executing families. There are thousands of families that have been completely annihilated.
They are 30,000 martyrs. I don't know what the Israelis want from us and why they killed this number. It is a genocide of the Palestinian people. This is what I see, a genocide. Who bombs a tower on civilian residents, including women and children?
We've never witnessed such a number before. I'm 52 years old and I've lived through many wars, including the 82 war, which we heard about when we were young, as well as the first and second intifadas. The number of 30,000 martyrs has never been reached in such a short period, 4 months, 5 months. The intifada lasted for years, yet this number wasn't reached, nor was the number of injuries. The goal here is killing, not just displacement, but murder and extermination.
This has become a genocide unlike anything we've ever seen. Everyone is suffering inside these tents. We're dying slowly in addition to high cost of living and the people enduring pain. We are suffering greatly. We have been displaced about 100 times.
Palestinian fighters keep putting stiff resistance to Israeli forces in Gaza as fighting on the ground rages on. The military wing of the Hamas resistance movement says it has targeted a group of Israeli soldiers in Gaza City with mortars. The Qassam Brigade says it also shelled Israeli armored vehicles there. Meanwhile, fighting continued in the southern city of Khan Yunis, where the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement says its fighters hit an Israeli Merkava tank, as well as a military bulldozer. Israel has so far confirmed the killing of 243 of its troopers since the regime launched a ground invasion of Gaza in late October. Palestinian groups say the regime is intentionally hiding the real number of casualties among its forces to avoid the Israeli public anger. Well, Israel's relentless bombings of the Gaza Strip and the obstacle to aid delivery have left Palestinians without food and other essentials. The UN has also warned that a quarter of Gaza's population is just one step away from famine. The lack of food has forced a displaced family to eat cactus leaves to survive. Let's take a listen to their harrowing narratives.
Today we are living in famine. We have exhausted everything. There is nothing left to eat. We used to eat a plant called mallow. It no longer exists. There used to be carrot and that is gone. There is nothing left in the markets. So we resorted to the last option, the cactus. We eat cactus even with its thorns. We even feed the young children cactus. A little girl is eating cactus instead of milk, instead of meat, instead of eggs. Today we can still find cactus. In a week the cactus will no longer be available and we will live on nothing. We will become dead. I, in approximately 1 month, and I have a photo, have lost some 30 kilograms this month. 1 month, I have lost 30 kilograms. Why? Because there is no food. This is our food now in the northern Gaza Strip. There is nothing else. Everything is gone. There is nothing left.
There is nothing. I have newborn babies. What should I feed them? They have become anemic. They have contracted due to lack of food and nutrition. So now we are eating cactus. I also ate from it. I ate cactus. I had cactus for lunch. We thank God. There is nothing left for us to eat.
Iran has launched yet another homegrown satellite as the country aims to bridge the gap with other nations in the race for space dominance.
Главное – подъем.
Контакт подъема. Двигатели центрального и боковых блока вышли на режим ландвения. 10 секунд. Параметры системы управления ракетами системы. 20 секунд. Двигатели первой и второй ступени.
The new satellite Pars-1 aboard a Soyuz launch vehicle was blasted off from a Russian space base and successfully put into orbit 500 kilometers above Earth. The imaging and research satellite will provide a set of remote sensing data that can be used in various fields, including land, forest, water monitoring, and mining and energy transmission lines. The domestically made satellite weighs 150 kilograms and is capable of capturing images of 95% of Iranian territory. This is the second foreign launch of an Iranian satellite. Last year, Iran launched the Khayyam satellite from a space launching pad in Kazakhstan. Iran is among the world's top 10 countries capable of developing and launching satellites. Our correspondent Farzaneh Ashourian, who was present at Iran's Space Research Institute during the satellite launch from a Russian base, told us more about the country's achievements in this field.
Actually, this satellite is called Pars-1. It's an imaging satellite. It's a research one. And actually, it's a research measurement satellite, and which is designed and constructed, as I mentioned, by the young scientists and Iranian scientists. And this launch was announced by Iran's communication minister, Zarepour, yesterday, noting that this actually launch is in order to develop international interactions and to develop the international relations between the two countries, between Iran and Russia. And we know that this launch is happening despite the unilateral Western sanctions. And we know that this is not actually the first time that Iran has done such thing and has launched a satellite more than 11 times. This actually proud moment has happened. And last month, what I can tell about the history of these kind of activities that Iran has, last month, Iran successfully put into orbit three homegrown satellites with a minimum altitude of 450 kilometers and a maximum of 1,100 kilometers above the Earth's surface.
Podcaster and journalist Esha Krishnaswamy joined us earlier from St. Petersburg with her take on the Iranian satellite launch from a Russian base.
I've been reading what Western papers have been saying, and they are saying that it expresses like concerns over Iran's ties with Moscow, etc. So they are definitely concerned about this because they want to have space hegemony or be one of the only people who are capable of doing this. And when other countries do this, it incites fear. But for Iran, what it does is that because Iran is a victim of so much terrorism and sabotage, it can help them monitor this and put an end to a lot of these issues where pipelines get sabotaged or get blown up due to acts of terrorists. So for Iran, it is vital for their national security interests. And so I think that it is overall something Iran needs in order to confront the real threats to their nation. it says that Iran is able to defend itself very capably. On top of that, I think these sanctions forced Iran into creating a self-sufficiency because they couldn't import parts that other nations could. And because of it, they have to manufacture everything at home. And so I think it helped create a self-sufficiency that made Iran ironically stronger if it weren't for the strength.
In Iran, candidates vying for seats in parliament and the assembly of experts have wrapped up their election campaigns. Millions of Iranians will be heading to the polls on Friday to cast their ballots for a 290-member parliament and an 88-seat assembly of experts. Iran's interior ministry says over 15,000 candidates are competing in the parliamentary elections this year, a record since the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979. The Iranian legislative body called Majlis is elected for a 4-year term. Hundreds of candidates are also in the fray for the Assembly of Experts, a deliberative body elected for 8 years. In his recent speech, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, called for massive voter turnout for elections, which he described as the main pillar of the Islamic Republic. Elsewhere, a German naval frigate taking part in a European mission in the Red Sea has mistakenly opened fire on an American MQ-9 Reaper drone, nearly shooting it down. According to German media, the frigate fired 2 missiles at the drone, but both crashed into the sea because of a technical defect. Germany's defense ministry has confirmed the incident, which took place on Monday. It said the frigate opened fire after efforts to identify an unknown drone were unsuccessful, and none of Germany's allies reported the drone in the area. The frigate was deployed to the Red Sea as part of an EU mission to allegedly secure international shipping from attacks by the Yemeni army, during past months. Yemen's armed forces have launched numerous attacks on Israel-linked ships in support of the Palestinian people in Gaza. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Election in view of Imam Khomeini and Ayatollah Khamenei. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. The 12th round of parliamentary election and the 6th round of the Assembly of Experts election will be held in Iran on March 1st, 2024. The Iranian people will go to ballot boxes to elect the candidates of the Islamic Council Assembly, called Majlis, and the Assembly of Experts. This will once more manifest the unity of the followers of various faiths, religious sects and ethnicities in the vast Iranian land. The Islamic Council Assembly, Majlis, is one of the 3 branches of power according to the Constitution of the Islamic Republic of Iran. It is the main basis of legislature in the country, and the members of the Majlis are elected with the direct votes of people for a 4-year term.
The Assembly of Experts, however, is a unique body in Iran which has been shaped since the victory of the Islamic Revolution. This organization has the duty of appointment of leader and supervision of the leader's performance. It can also dismiss the leader when needed. According to the Constitution of the Islamic Republic of Iran, during the time of occultation of Imam Mahdi, the 12th infallible Imam from the Prophet's progeny, the country and the Islamic Ummah is led by a just and God-wary jurisprudent. He is aware of the circumstances of time, is brave, and a prudent administrator. Such a jurisprudent is elected by the Assembly of Experts, as they are specialized in finding the qualifications for the most important position in the country. The members of the Assembly of Experts are elected for an 8-year term. Among the most important reasons for election in the Islamic Republic of Iran, as a religious rule, are the emphasis of the Quran and the narrations from the Prophet and his 12 infallible successors, blessings of God upon them. God says in verse 11 of chapter Ra'd of the Noble Quran, "Indeed, Allah does not change a people's lot unless they change what is in their souls." Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, also says, "No people consults except that is guided to the best way." In addition, Imam Ali, peace upon him, said that if there were not the big number of those who swear allegiance, he would abandon caliphate and rule of the Islamic Ummah. Moreover, Prophet has said elsewhere, "Whoever starts his day while he is indifferent towards the affairs of Muslims, he is not a Muslim." According to the founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Imam Khomeini, and his successor, Ayatollah Khamenei, too, elections are very important. Imam Khomeini used to emphasize on the high status and role of elections and would persuade everybody to take part in all elections. The Imam would consider election as one of the honors of the Islamic Republic system. He said that election is a picture of freedom and independence of the country. He made it clear several times that no one, including the ulema and the elite, is entitled to impose their view on people, and it is people who have the right to shape their fate. In view of this, the Imam said, "We have no right. God the Exalted has not granted us the right. The Prophet of Islam has not given us the right to impose anything upon our nation." Elsewhere, Imam Khomeini said, "The authority should be in people's hand. This is a rational issue. Every wise person accepts this issue, that the ordainments of everyone should be in his own hand." Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei also puts high emphasis on elections. He said, "The prime importance of election is because election is the trench of country. People's presence at ballot boxes immunizes the fate of nation and people and prevents the enemy from invasion, aggression, and further impudence." The leader said nearly 20 years ago, "Our country relies on people's votes. The reason why the enemies of the nation and those who look avariciously at this land have failed to deal any harm to it is the presence, will, and participation of people in different scenes." In view of the leader, elections are among the faithful and sensitive arenas of the country. He calls elections as the night of Qadr of the Islamic system, since it determines the affairs of the country for 4 years. He says, The republicanism and Islamism of the system both depend on election because materialization of republicanism and Islamism and the rule of people in the administration of the country has no way but holding of election. Ayatollah Khamenei says elsewhere, election is injection of fresh blood into the body of the Islamic Republic system. It is the renewal of power and force for the nation. Election means this. It means injecting a new spirit, a new blood, and a new breath into the country, into the nation, and into the people. This is election. Ayatollah Khamenei clarifies election as follows. It is both a right and an obligation for people to come and determine the fate of their country carefully, as the country belongs to the people. People should come and, through correct and free election, determine the lawmakers in the legislature, determine their directors as it has been assigned in the law. This is the people's right and it belongs to them, but it is an obligation too. It is not that one says, I don't want to apply my right. No, the fate of the system depends on application and wielding of this right. This is an obligation. Everyone should participate. Election is both the right of nation and a national duty. The Islamic Republic system has annulled the systems which appoint power, and it granted the people's election a role in the administration of the country. This is the right of each person in the country to be able to elect and play a role in determining the manager of the country. Furthermore, it is a duty too, because this participation can keep alive the spirit of vividness and sense of responsibility in the society forever, and it can manifest people's presence boastfully in the face of the enemies of this nation. Election is not a mere duty. It is not a mere right either. It is both your right and a public duty. Ayatollah Khamenei says on the status of election, election per se is the symbol of national might. If the dear Iranian nation manages to bring its ample votes to the scene in this election, and the people's presence is spectacular, this will be the greatest symbol of might and national dignity. The leader maintains that broad participation in election will ensure the country, as he says, people's presence in election will ensure the country de facto. Election is the real indicator of people's presence in the country's political scene. Every election which is held fervently will ensure the country. In his recent remarks to the visiting people of East Azerbaijan province, Ayatollah Khamenei said, everyone should participate in the election. Election is the main basis of the Islamic Republic system. Election is the course of the country's reform. Those who intend to solve problems and to repair, they should come to election. The accurate way is to elect.
Doing us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
We'll be right back.
Israeli genocidal war in Gaza continues for the 145th day, with the death toll nearing 30,000. The U.S. president had a few words to say about a truce deal that's being discussed. Licking on some ice cream, he said that there will be a truce by Monday. Well, this goes flat against what Hamas political bureau chief Ismail Haniyeh has said, and also the Hamas rep in Lebanon, Osama Hamdan. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at the genocidal war and how nothing has prevented civilian killings, from the ICJ to protests to a possible truce deal, a genocide made possible by the U.S. providing the Israeli regime with bombs and missiles. First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of The Spotlight. John Phoenix, journalist and international relations expert, joins us from London. Also joining us is Nicholas Davis, independent journalist and author, who joins us from Miami. Well, welcome to you both. If I may start with you, John Phoenix, when we take a look at what's happening in Gaza, it's quite incredible and shocking that we're approaching 30,000 in terms of the death toll, 145 days now, and just in the past 24 hours, over 100 Palestinians have been murdered. What do you think about the fact that nothing is preventing the genocide from stopping?
Well, just let's make it clear that the main factor of the support for the Israeli army genocide in Gaza is obviously the American government. If the United States wanted to end this massacre, wanted to end this genocide, you only had to pressure the Israelis and stop their sending daily ammunition and daily support for the Israelis. In fact, they're clear now from the reports that even the from the last, I think, 26 of December till now, Israel did not, after the CCJ, stop killing the Palestinians. You know, so the only pressure can actually stop the Zionist entity killing more Palestinians is the Americans, because on the other hand you have the neighboring Arab regimes, who is actually as clear now from what happening 145 days, they are obviously American puppets who cannot take any decision. They fail even to actually smuggle, not even deliver, smuggle a glass of water to the Palestinians who are starving in Gaza, especially the north of Gaza. Obviously no food at all. People dropping dead on the north because of the lack of food and mm-hmm. medicine and water. They starvation became a weapon now in the hand of the Israelis, because they make it clear, as one of their member of the parliament said, if we starve them, they will be able to come and give us information about Hamas. So it's actually intent to starve people to death. You know, so the way out of this misery is only the Americans, the government who are sponsoring this massacres, who are sponsoring this genocide.
Sure, sure. Well, let's talk a little bit more on the humanitarian level before we get into the American complicity, I should say. And Nicholas Davis, when you take a look at, for example, the UN organizations, you had a recent incident on February the 5th where the Israeli regime forces fired at the UN convoy that was carrying vital supplies of food for the starving Palestinians. And at the same time, the regime forces, they blocked these trucks. And that has led many to say food is being used as a weapon of war. So much so that the humanitarian organizations are saying, you know, we're not going to be able to function in the Gaza Strip as it is. It's been almost impossible. Why do you think Israel is using food as a weapon of war? I guess they talked about how it wants to extract information on Hamas, but is that the only reason?
Well, no, of course not. And I mean, this is an integral part of why the ICJ has essentially accepted that this is a case of genocide. Because clearly the intent is to completely destroy Gaza and kill thousands of civilians. You know, this is not what the Americans like to call collateral damage. These are actually the targets. Under whatever pretext the Israelis come up with, the goal is to make Gaza uninhabitable and to inflict so much death and destruction and sheer terror on the people of Gaza that eventually Israel will be able to push them out into Egypt or just out into the desert. None of the pretexts cited have any validity whatsoever. This is genocide, pure and simple.
You talked about the U.S. assistance, John Phoenix. Maybe you could expand a little bit more about how vast this is. We have at some point a Pentagon spokesman said that the security assistance continues to arrive on a near daily basis to the Israeli regime. Throughout this time, the U.S. is saying, not throughout this time really, but in the past month or so, that it's telling Israel to really watch out for the civilian casualties. But it continues to supply Israel, not just sporadically, but almost on a daily basis, if not daily. How much of a contributing factor is that to the genocide taking place?
Well, from the beginning of genocide, from the October, when the Americans actually noted that the Israelis killing civilians, they did not actually stop the Israelis killing civilians. They actually denied the figures. If you remember, Biden said, I do not obviously believe Hamas figures. These figures was coming from the United Nations and other independent organizations who were saying the civilians being targeted, houses being demolished, children and women being killed, hundreds of kids under the rivers. So the Americans know that there is, when I say Americans, I mean the American government, they know that there is targeting deliberately civilians. Now, that's explain why they, that's obviously explain why they have 8,800 women, killed, 7,000 children killed. So 75% of the casualty in Gaza are civilians. And under the pretext of fighting Hamas, there's no Hamas to fight. I don't see the logic that Israelis by bombing houses and killing civilians, it's fighting Hamas. 65% of the houses in Gaza destroyed. A total of 80%, the rest of the figure, houses you cannot return to, had to be demolished and rebuilt. So it's clear that the American government is not only aiding, they are part of that, because they are not only sending weapons daily to the Israelis. They have actually storage in Negev Desert, which has been there for years and years. Every time they fought Hamas in Gaza, or they attacked the Palestinians in Gaza, the storage is full. But at this time, the toll of the war is taking longer than 33 days last time, or 25 days the time before. This now nearly 6 months. So the Israelis need a supply, and Americans happy to supply them to slaughter more Palestinians. Now, you're talking about the issue of Rafah. Rafah, they've been attacking, actually, on the edges of Rafah. They killed people yesterday. They bombed houses in Rafah. So the media actually knew that, they're stopping now because of Ramadan. They're not attacking Rafah. They're actually attacking houses in Rafah. And the sad thing to see yesterday when the Jordanian, after all this pressure and being exposed, actually aiding the Zionists and sending them food, they dropped some food yesterday and ended up in the sea. The poor people went to the sea to actually to collect it. They've been shot at by snipers. Indeed. So you mentioned about the trucks. There's no point sending the trucks to Gaza where Palestinians, civilians cannot reach it. There's snipers everywhere. These trucks had to be aided by international force to be able to deliver this to the civilians. Otherwise, you can have food in the street and you cannot reach to it.
Sure. Well, let's talk about this self-immolation that has taken place in Nicholas Davies, which I'm sure you're aware of. When you take a look at what has happened, the depth of this is not really being reflected by U.S. officials, especially the U.S. President Joe Biden. We're looking at this Aaron Bushnell, who gave up his life for the genocide and the slaughter that's taking place. But the fact that he did that, in addition to the fact that he was a U.S. military person, points to whether the genocide has reached a degree where you have American public to actually be awakened to the point where one of them, this brave Aaron Bushnell, went and self-immolated and killed himself because of that. Has the awareness gotten to that point?
Yes, and I would add first that you know, the U.S. role is not limited to providing weapons. Right at the beginning, they sent a U.S. Marine General, James Glynn, who took part in the U.S. Virtually genocidal destruction of Mosul and before that of Fallujah in Iraq, to help the Israelis plan this whole operation. And there are U.S. military personnel in Israel continuing to do that, continuing to work with the Israelis to help them to use these U.S. weapons to kill more Palestinians. I heard yesterday a friend of a friend who works in Florida here for a company called L3 Harris, who his friend believes is currently in Israel because L3 Harris helps to build the so-called Iron Dome Israeli and, you know, missile defense system. So there are American technicians in Israel working to maintain the weapons that are sold there, and there are intelligence officials and senior military officers helping Israel to plan and target these weapons on civilians in Gaza. Now, when it comes to Aaron Bushnell, since October, I believe, he had been under orders to be prepared to deploy to the Middle East or to Israel. So he explicitly, was implicated. The Air Force unit that he works with was on deck to be sent to the Middle East to take part in this war. So he probably more than most Americans felt complicit, because actually, in fact, he is implicit. The Air Force that he is part of mm-hmm. is part of the war. And I thought his statement on Facebook before he did this was just incredibly eloquent. He said, how many times have we all asked ourselves, what would we do if, you know, we were alive at the time of slavery of African Americans sure. in America, or if we were, you know, in Germany taking part in the genocide or hearing about the genocide that their country was committing. And he said, well, we don't have to wonder anymore. He said, every one of you can now answer the question, what are you doing mm-hmm. while your country is committing genocide? And the answer is, obviously, for most Americans, it is little or nothing, or even actually supporting it.
Indeed.
So that is the answer to the question. And I had a conversation with somebody yesterday who talked about how terrible Trump is, and I said, well, you know, Biden is clear. How
right.
can anybody be worse than a president who is committing genocide?
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, we're looking at another instance that we can make a comparison here, John Phoenix, to go along the same topic, and that is back in 2003, where you had Rachel Corrie. I don't know if you recall what she did at that point. And I'm going to refer to what she said then. I think it's a good idea for us all to drop everything and devote our lives to making this stop. I don't think it's an extremist thing to do anymore. Fast forward to 2024 with Aaron Bushnell. Compared to what people have been experiencing in Palestine at the hands of their colonizers, this is not extreme at all. You have these two instances happen, but yet U.S. politicians, Joe Biden, you know, he's not made really any, not really, he hasn't made any reaction or statements on what has happened. Why do you think this has been the case, and why do you think all these years you still are getting the silence from the U.S. government on people who are sacrificing themselves for causes that they believe in like this?
Well, if you look at the case of Rachel Corrie, when she was in Gaza, the way she was killed, that she was trying to stop a bulldozer of actually destroying a house. And the driver actually drove over her, killed her. It was clear that she was shouting, making it clear that she's in front of him. He ignored her, warning to him, and managed to kill her. Now, not only that the soldier killed her, when the family decided to take the army to court, the American officials were siding with the Israelis against an American citizen. You know, it take maybe six, seven meetings with the their solicitor in Tel Aviv, and it was clear that the American officials, especially from the American embassy, taking the side of the Israelis. The only crime she committed that she tried to protect the family, where she stayed, actually having to stay in few houses in Gaza to help the Palestinian refugees, and that's what happened. So obviously the American government had a barrage of threat and pressure from the Zionist lobby not to side with the victims, side with Israel, and that's what happened. It was clear that AIPAC was working hard to be sure that the Israelis would not be indicted in that crime.
Sure. Well, we are looking now at what's been coming out from Paris, the news that has now been spread in the past couple of days regarding a possibility of a truce, which there are differing signals, the divisiveness between what the Americans have said, even the Qataris, and what Hamas and the resistance has said, Nicholas Davies. And I'd like to get your reaction to it, because on the one hand, Joe Biden, and I can't believe that they actually... I mean, it doesn't look good when the president is licking an ice cream and answering reporters talking about Palestinians and God. It just doesn't look good. Correct me if I'm wrong. But he said that there's a deal on Monday, and yet you have Hamas that came out hours later practically and said that there's still large gaps remain, kind of the same type of reaction that Hamas had to the previous truce. Tell us what you think about what's out there regarding this so-called truce that's in the works.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, this has been going on for weeks, that the U.S. Will come out with saying that, you know, there is some sort of deal on the table. But when you look at the details, it's clear that there isn't, and essentially they are trying to impose on Hamas an agreement in which Hamas would release the Israeli hostages in exchange for a temporary truce, and then the bombing and Israeli assault would recommence. And clearly, Hamas has clearly rejected that over and over and over again. And Hamas demands what the whole world is demanding, which is an actual ceasefire, an end to the genocide. And the U.S. is complicit also in fostering a view of this whole crisis that that implies a reciprocity between on the actions of Hamas on October the 7th, and Israel's genocide and war crimes. And in fact, the Secretary General of the UN was absolutely explicit in introducing one of the UN Security Council sessions, which the US eventually vetoed. And he said, you know, yes, we condemn what Hamas did on October the 7th, but Israel's obligations under international humanitarian law are independent of whatever happened on October the 7th. Mm-hmm. And they do not depend on any kind of reciprocity. We are talking about enforcing international law, enforcing the Genocide Convention. It doesn't, you know, in terms of stopping genocide, it actually does not matter what sure. Hamas did, because they do not provide, what Hamas did does not provide, cannot provide a legitimate pretext for genocide.
Right. Well, it seems like throughout the questions that I've asked and the responses that I've gotten, we can't escape the role that the U.S. Has played, John Phoenix, in this. And the U.S. itself was a focus of the most recent G20 meeting that was held in Brazil, so much so that the Brazilian president came out, talked about the U.S. role there, and actually then made the focus of the G20, in some sense, the reform of the U.N., because the Brazilian president and the other officials that were present there, aside from looking down at the U.S., have said this is where the U.N. has failed. It needs to be reformed. We've heard that before about the U.N. being reformed, but here is a clear example of how bad things can go. What do you think about nothing to have at this point prevented the genocide from stopping?
Well, can I just highlight one thing before I answer the question? You sound like a little bit surprised about the ice cream incident, you know. I mean, you're talking to about a president who is actually forget what he ate in the morning. When he came to the media and talking about genocide, he knows what the issue, killing civilians, starvation, and he's eating ice cream, which is an insult. That reminds me of the when I watch the Schindler List, and one of the Nazi officers attacking an old lady and the other officer laughing, you know. This is really disgusting to see a president of the United States talking about an issue which is killing, genocide, starvation, and eating ice cream. That is really a shame, you know. But I do not really obviously blame him. I mean, he just mentioned that he met Mitterrand in the conference in France, which Mitterrand died 30 years ago. Mm. He called Sisi president of Mexico. So do not blame him for that, please. You know, yeah. In regard to Brazil, not only Brazil, even Algeria tabled a decision, a motion that this genocide should be stopped, you know, because there's no end to this cycle. Israelis have a free hand. They know that the Americans will veto any decision. Now, talking about the reform of the United Nations, and I mean, anybody can ask the same question, is how come 30 countries, 40, 120 countries would take a decision to stop a genocide, and then one country can override this decision? Surely we need to have a reform where other countries who are not sitting there like sheep, you know, and four countries control the United Nations, you know. So it is really time for reform and time for other countries to have its say on international affairs.
Okay, thank you very much. We're going to have to end in there. Let me thank John Phoenix, journalist and international relations expert. And thank you, Nicholas Davies, independent journalist and author from Miami. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tawai and the team, it's goodbye.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
النقي means the pure, the immaculate, the clean. Al-Hadi means the guide. All the Imams came for guidance.
As-salamu alaykum ya ahla bayt al-nubuwa wa mawdu' al-risala wa mukhtalaf al-malawi.
Peace be upon the directors of right guidance, the lanterns in darkness, the patterns of piety.
This is Dialogue, an introduction into the most important dialogues and conversations of Imam Ali ibn Muhammad al-Hadi alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. This is Dialogue. I'm your host Mahdi. Imam Ali ibn Muhammad al-Hadi alayhi salam was a pure source of wisdom and knowledge. Despite his young age, he showed what divinely gifted knowledge really looks like. Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Messenger of Allah, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household. Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam was also the 10th divinely appointed Imam, and he was the 10th divinely appointed successor of the Messenger of Allah, peace and blessings upon him. Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam was also the son of the 9th divinely appointed Imam, Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam. After Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam answered with the answers of an expert the most difficult of questions posed to him by the Shia scholars and jurisprudents, the Shia leaders at that time had more faith and certainty now of what they had previously believed, that a divinely appointed Imam must have the most knowledge and he must be the most knowledgeable one of his time, regardless of whether he is young or old. And so the knowledge, virtue, and the delving into the sciences of the Holy Quran and the Sunnah of Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam astonished the minds and sparked meetings and gatherings in all parts of the Muslim world. At this moment, we invite you to listen to parts of the Arabic text of Ziyarat Jamiatul Kabira by Imam Hadi alayhi salam, along with its English translation. Please stay tuned.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. As-salamu ala a'immatil huda wa masabihit tuja wa a'lamit tuqa wa dawin nuha.
In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Peace be upon the directors of right guidance, the lanterns in darkness, the patterns of piety, the owners of understanding, the endued with thought, the havens of the peoples, the inheritors of the prophets, the perfect specimen, the most excellent call in the arguments of Allah against the inhabitants of the world, the hereafter and the former world. Allah's mercy and blessings too be upon you all.
Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. As-salamu ala mahal ma'rifah.
Peace be upon the exponents of the recognition of Allah, the centers of Allah's blessing, the essence of Allah's wisdom, the keepers of Allah's secrets, the bearers of Allah's book, the successor of Allah's prophet, and the progeny of Allah's messenger. May Allah send blessings upon him and his household. Allah's mercy and blessing.